Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Kiss of the Highlander by Karen Marie Mawning, performed by Phil Giganti. This one's for you, Mom. When I raged, you listened. When I wept, you held me. When I ran away, you brought me back. When I dreamed, you believed. Woman of immeasurable wisdom and grace, you have been all that a mother could be, and more. I cannot believe God plays dice with the cosmos. Albert Einstein. God not only plays dice, he sometimes throws the dice where they cannot be seen. Stephen Hawking. Highlands of Scotland, 1518. Prologue.
The MacAltar is a dangerous man, Nevin.
What are you going on about this time, Mother?
Nevin looked out the window and watched the grass rippling in the early morning sun beyond their hut. His mother was reading fortunes, and were he foolish enough to turn around and meet Bassetta's gaze, she would interpret it as encouragement, and he would be lured into yet another conversation about some bewildering prediction. His mother's wits, never the sharpest blade in the armory, were dulling daily, eroded by suspicious imaginings.
My eustachs have warned me that the laird presents a grave danger to ye.
The laird? Tristan MacAltar?
Startled, Nevin glanced over his shoulder. Tucked behind the table near the hearth, his mother straightened in her chair, preening beneath his attention. Now he'd done it, he thought, with an inward sigh. He'd gotten himself snagged in her conversation as securely as he'd gotten his long robes entangled in a thorny bramble a time or two, and it would require finesse to detach himself now without things degenerating into an age-old argument. Bassetta Alexander had lost so much in her life that she clung too fiercely to what she had left, Nevin. He repressed a desire to fling back the door and flee into the serenity of the Highland morning, aware that she would only corner him again at the earliest opportunity. Instead, he said gently,
"Tristan MacAltar is not a danger to me. He is a fine laird, and 'tis honored I am to have been chosen to oversee the spiritual guidance of his clan."
Bassetta shook her head, her lip trembling. A fleck of spittle foamed at the seam.
"You see with a priest's narrow view. You can't see what I see. This is dire indeed, Nevin."
He gave her his most reassuring smile, one that, despite his youth, had eased the troubled hearts of countless sinners.
"Will you cease trying to divine my well-being with your sticks and runes? Each time I am assigned a new position, you reach for your charms.
What kind of a mother would I be if I didn't take interest in your future?"
she cried. Brushing a lock of blonde hair from his face, Nevin crossed the room and kissed her wrinkled cheek, then swept his hand across the yew sticks, upsetting their mysterious design.
"I am an ordained man of God, yet here you sit reading fortunes."
He took her hand and patted it soothingly.
"You must let go of the old ways. How will I achieve success with the villagers if my own dear mother persists in pagan rituals?"
he teased. Bassetta snatched her hand from his and gathered her sticks defensively.
"These are far more than simple sticks. I'll pick you. Accord them proper respect. He must be stopped."
"What do your sticks tell you the laird will do that is so terrible?"
Curiosity trumped his resolve to end this conversation as neatly as possible. He couldn't hope to curtail the dark wanderings of her mind if he didn't know what they were.
"He will soon take a lady, and she will do you harm. I think she will kill you."
Nevin's mouth opened and closed like a trout stranded on the riverbank. Although he knew there was no truth to her ominous prediction, the fact that she entertained such wicked thoughts confirmed his fears that her tenuous grasp on reality was slipping.
"Why would anyone kill me? I'm a priest, for heaven's sake."
"I can't see the why of it. Mayhap his new lady will take a fancy to you, and evil doings will come of it."
"Now, you truly are imagining things. A fancy to me, over Tristan MacAltar."
Bassetta glanced at him, then quickly away.
You are a fine-looking lad, Nevin.
She lied with motherly aplomb. Nevin laughed. Of Basetta's 5 sons, only he had been born slender of build, with fine bones and a quietude that served God well, but king and country poorly. He knew what he looked like. He had not been fashioned, as had Drustan MacKelter, for warring, conquering, and seducing women, and had long ago accepted his physical shortcomings. God had purpose for him, and while spiritual purpose might seem insignificant to others, for Nevin Alexander it was more than enough.
Put those sticks away, Mother, and I don't want to hear any more of this nonsense. You needn't fret on my behalf. God watches over...
He stopped mid-sentence. What he'd nearly said would encourage an entirely new and at the same time very old and very lengthy discussion. Basetta's eyes narrowed.
Ah, yes. Your God certainly watched over all of my sons, didn't he?
Her bitterness was palpable and made him heartsick. Of all his flock, he'd failed most surely with his own mother.
I might remind you that quite recently he was your God, when I was granted this position and you were well pleased with my promotion,
Nevin said lightly.
And you will not harm the MacKelter, Mother.
Basetta smoothed her coarse gray hair and angled her nose toward the thatched roof.
Don't you have confessions to hear, Nevin?
You must not jeopardize our position here, Mother, he said gently. We have a solid home among fine people, and I hope to make it permanent. Give me your word.
Basetta kept her eyes fixed on the roof in stubborn silence.
Look at me, Mother. You must promise.
When he refused to retract his demand or avert his steady gaze, she finally gave a shrug and nodded.
I will not harm the MacKelter, Nevin. Now, go on with you,
she said brusquely.
This old woman has things to do.
Satisfied that his mother wouldn't trouble the laird with her pagan foolishness, Nevin departed for the castle. God willing, his mother would forget her latest delusion by dinner. God willing. Over the next few days, Basetta tried to make Nevin understand the danger he was in, to no avail. He chided her gently, he rebuked her less gently, and he got those sad lines around his mouth she so hated to see. Lines that clearly pronounced, "My mother's going mad." Despair settled into her weary bones, and she knew that it was up to her to do something. She would not lose her only remaining son. It wasn't fair that a mother should outlive all her children, and trusting God to protect them was what had gotten her into this bind to begin with. She refused to believe she'd been given the ability to foresee events only to sit back and do nothing about them. When shortly after her alarming vision a band of wandering Rome arrived in the village of Ballinach, Basetta struck upon a solution. It took time to barter with the proper people, although proper was hardly a word she'd use to describe the people with whom she was forced to deal. Basetta might read yew sticks, but simple scrying paled in comparison to the practices of the wild gypsies who wandered the highlands, selling spells and enchantments cheek by jowl with their more ordinary wares. Worse still, she'd had to steal Nevin's precious gold-leafed Bible, which he used only on the holiest of days, to trade for the services she purchased, and when he discovered the loss come Yuletide, he would be heartbroken. But he would be alive by the yew. Although Basetta suffered many sleepless nights over her decision, she knew her sticks had never failed her. If she didn't do something to prevent it, Drustan MacKelter would take a wife, and that woman would kill her son. That much her sticks had made clear. If her sticks had told her more, mayhap how the woman would do it, when or why, she might not have been seized by such desperation. How would she survive if Nevin were gone? Who would succor an old and useless woman? Alone, the great yawning darkness with its great greedy maw would swallow her whole. She had no choice but to get rid of Drustan MacKelter. A senate later, Basetta stood with the gypsies and their leader, a silver-haired man named Rushka, in the clearing near the little loch some distance west of Castle Keltar. Drustin McKelter lay unconscious at her feet. She eyed him warily. The McKelter was a large man, towering and dark, a mountain of bronzed muscle and sinew, even when flat on his back, when she shivered and nudged him gingerly with her toe. The gypsies laughed.
The moon could fall on him and he wouldn't waken,
Rushka informed her, his dark gaze amused.
You're certain?
Bassetta pressed.
'Tis no natural sleep.
You didn't kill him, did you?
She fretted.
I promised Nevin I wouldn't harm him.
Rushka arched a brow.
You have an interesting code, old woman,
he mocked.
Nay, we did not kill him. He but slumbers and will eternally. 'Tis an ancient spell, laid most carefully.
When Rushka turned away, instructing his men to place the enchanted laird in the wagon, Bassetta heaved a sigh of relief. It had been risky, slipping into the castle, drugging the laird's wine and luring him to the clearing near the lock. But all had gone according to plan. He'd collapsed on the bank of the glassy lake, and the gypsies had set about their ritual. They'd painted strange symbols upon his chest, sprinkled herbs and chanted. Although the gypsies made her uneasy, and she'd longed to flee back to the safety of her cottage, she'd forced herself to watch, to be certain the canny gypsies would keep their word, and to assure herself Nevin was finally safe, forever beyond Drustin McKelter's reach. The moment the final words of the spell had been uttered, the very air in the clearing had changed. She'd felt an uncommon iciness, suffered a sudden, overwhelming weariness, even glimpsed a strange light settling around the laird's body. The gypsies indeed possessed powerful magic.
Truly, eternally?
Bassetta pressed.
He will ne'er awaken?
I told you, old woman,
Rushka said impatiently.
The man will slumber, frozen, utterly untouched by time, ne'er to awaken, unless both human blood and sunshine commingle upon the spell etched upon his chest.
Blood and sunshine would wake him! That must never happen!
Bassetta exclaimed, panicking all over again.
It won't. You have my word. Not where we plan to hide his body. Sunlight will ne'er reach him in the underground caverns near Loch Ness. None will e'er find him. None know of the place but us.
You must hide him very deep,
Bassetta pressed.
Seal him in. He must never be found.
I say you have my word,
Rushka said sharply. When the gypsies, wagon in tow, disappeared into the forest, Bassetta sank to her knees in the clearing and murmured a prayer of thanks to whatever deity might be listening. Any idle feelings of guilt were far outweighed by relief, and she consoled herself with the thought that she hadn't really hurt him. He was, as she had promised Nevin, unharmed, essentially. Highlands of Scotland, September 19th, present day. Chapter 1. Gwen Cassidy needed a man. Desperately. Failing that, she'd settle for a cigarette.
God, I hate my life,
she thought.
I don't even know who I am anymore.
Glancing around the crowded interior of the tour bus, Gwen took a deep breath and rubbed the nicotine patch under her arm. After this fiasco, she deserved a cigarette, didn't she? Except, even if she managed to escape the horrid bus and find a pack, she was afraid she might expire from nicotine overdose if she smoked one. The patch made her feel shaky and ill. Perhaps before quitting, she should have waited until she'd found her cherry picker, she mused. It wasn't as if she was drawing them like flies to honey in her current mood. Her virginity was hardly presented in its best light when she kept snarling at every man she met. She leaned back against the cracked seat, wincing when the bus hit a pothole and caused the wiry coils of the seat to dig into her shoulder blade. Even the smooth, mysterious, slate-gray surface of Loch Ness beyond the rattling window that wouldn't stay closed when it rained, and wouldn't stay open otherwise, failed to intrigue her.
Gwen, are you feeling all right?
Bert Hardy asked kindly from across the aisle. Gwen peered at Bert through her Jennifer Aniston-fringed bangs, expensively beveled to attract her own Brad Pitt. Right now, they simply tickled her nose and annoyed her. Bert had proudly informed her, when they'd begun the tour a week ago, that he was 73 and sex had never been better. This said while patting the hand of his newlywed, plump, and blushing bride, Beatrice. Gwen had smiled politely and congratulated them, and since that mild show of interest, had become the doting couple's favorite young American lassie.
"I'm fine, Bert,"
she assured him, wondering where he'd found the lemon polyester shirt and the golf turf green trousers that clashed painfully with his white leather dress shoes and tartan socks. Completing the rainbow ensemble, a red wool cardigan was neatly buttoned about his paunch.
"You don't look so well there, dearie,"
Beatrice fretted, adjusting a wide-brimmed straw hat atop her soft, silvery-blue curls.
"A little green about the gills."
"It's just the bumpy ride, Beatrice."
"Well, we're nearly to the village, and you must have a bite to eat with us before we go sightseeing,"
Bert said firmly.
"We can go see that house. You know, the one where that sorcerer Aleister Crowley used to live. They say it's haunted,"
he confided, wiggling bushy white brows. Gwen nodded apathetically. She knew it was futile to protest, because although she suspected Beatrice might have taken pity on her, Bert was determined to ensure that she had fun. It had taken her only a few days to figure out that she should never have embarked upon this ridiculous quest. But back home in Santa Fe, New Mexico, as she'd peered out the window of her cubicle at the Allstate Insurance Company, arguing with yet another injured insured who'd managed to amass an astounding $9,827 worth of chiropractic bills from an accident that had caused a mere $127 in damage to his rear bumper, the idea of being in Scotland, or anywhere else for that matter, had been irresistible. So she'd let a travel agent convince her that a 14-day tour through the romantic highlands and lowlands of Scotland was just what she needed, at the bargain price of $999. The price was acceptable. The mere thought of doing something so impulsive was terrifying, and precisely what she needed to shake up her life. She should have known that 14 days in Scotland for $1,000 had to be a senior citizen's bus tour. But she'd been so frantic to escape the drudgery and emptiness of her life that she'd only cursorily glanced through the itinerary, and not given her possible traveling companions a second thought. 38 senior citizens, ranging in age from 62 to 89, chatted, laughed, and embraced each new village-slash-pub-slash-bowel movement with boundless enthusiasm, and she knew that when they returned home they would play cards and regale their elderly and envious friends with endless anecdotes. She wondered what stories they would tell about the 25-year-old virgin who had traveled with them. Prickly as a porcupine? Stupid enough to try to give up smoking while taking the first real vacation in her life and simultaneously trying to divest herself of her virginity? She sighed. The seniors really were sweet, but sweet wasn't what she was looking for. She was looking for passionate, heart-pounding sex. Sex that was down and dirty, wild and sweaty and hot. Lately, she ached for something she couldn't even put a name to, something that made her restless and anxious when she watched Tenth Kingdom or her favorite star-crossed lover's quest, Lady Hawk. Were she still alive, her mother, renowned physicist Dr. Elizabeth Cassidy, would assure her it was nothing more than a biological urge programmed into her genes. Following in her mother's footsteps, Gwen had majored in physics, then worked briefly as a research assistant at Triton Corp while completing her Ph.D., before her great fit of rebellion had landed her at Allstate. Sometimes, when her head had been swimming with equations, she'd wondered if her mother wasn't right, if all there was to life could be explained by genetic programming and science. Popping a piece of gum in her mouth, Gwen stared out the window. She certainly wasn't going to find her cherry picker on this bus, nor had she entertained even a modicum of success in the prior villages. She had to do something soon, because if she didn't, she would end up going back home no different than she'd arrived. And frankly, that thought was more terrifying than the idea of seducing a man she hardly knew. The bus lurched to a halt, pitching Gwen forward. She struck her mouth on the metal frame of the seat in front of her. She cast an irate glance at the rotund, bald bus driver, wondering how the old folks always seemed to anticipate the sudden stop, when she never could. Were they simply more cautious with their brittle bones, strapped into the seats better, in cahoots with the ancient, portly driver? She dug in her backpack for her compact, and sure enough, her lower lip was swelling.
Well, maybe that will entice a man, she thought,
poking it out a little more as she dutifully followed Bert and Beatrice off the bus and into the sunny morning. Sucker lips. Didn't men fixate on plump lips?
I can't, Bert, she said when the kindly man tucked her arm in his. I need to be alone for a little while, she added apologetically.
Is your lip swollen again, dear?
Bert frowned.
Don't you wear your seatbelt? Are you sure you're okay?
Gwen ignored the first two questions.
I'm fine. I just want to go for a walk and gather my thoughts, she said,
trying not to notice that Beatrice was regarding her from beneath the wide brim of her hat with the unnerving intensity of a woman who had survived multiple daughters. Sure enough, Beatrice pushed Bert toward the front steps of the inn.
You go on, Bertie, she told her new husband. We girls need to chat a moment.
While her husband disappeared into the quaint thatch-roofed inn, Beatrice guided Gwen to a stone bench and pulled her down beside her.
There is a man for you, Gwen Cassidy, Beatrice said.
Gwen's eyes widened.
How do you know that's what I'm looking for?
Beatrice smiled, cornflower blue eyes crinkling in her plump face.
You listen to Beatrice, dearie. Fling caution to the wind. If I were your age and looked like you, I'd be shaking my bomb-bomb everywhere I went.
Bomb-bomb?
Gwen's eyebrows rose.
Petunia, dear. Booty, behind,
Beatrice said with a wink.
Get out there and find a man of your own. Don't let us spoil your trip, dragging you about. You don't need old folks like us around. You need a strapping young man to sweep you off your feet. And keep you off them for a good long while,
she said meaningfully.
But I can't find a man, Beatrice.
Gwen blew out a frustrated breath.
I've been searching for my cherry picker for months now.
Cherry? Oh!
Beatrice's round shoulders, swathed in pink wool and pearls, shook with laughter. Gwen winced.
Oh, God. How embarrassing. I can't believe I just said that. That's just what I started calling him in my mind because I'm the oldest living,
virgin?
Beatrice supplied helpfully with another laugh.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't a pretty young woman like you have a man back home?
Gwen sighed.
In the past 6 months, I've dated oodles of men.
She trailed off. After her prominent parents had been killed in a plane crash in March, returning from a conference in Hong Kong, she'd turned into a veritable dating machine. Her only relative, her grandfather on her father's side, had Alzheimer's and hadn't recognized her in forever. Lately, Gwen felt like the last Mohican, wandering around, desperate for some place to call home.
And?
Beatrice prodded.
And I'm not a virgin because I'm trying to be,
Gwen said grumpily.
I can't find a man I want, and I'm beginning to think the problem is me. Maybe I expect too much. Maybe I'm holding out for something that doesn't even exist.
She'd voiced her secret fear. Maybe grand passion was just a dream. With all the kissing she'd done in the past few months, she'd not once been overcome with desire. Her parents certainly hadn't had any great passion between them. Come to think of it, she wasn't sure she'd ever seen grand passion outside of a movie theater or a book.
Oh, dearie, don't think that, Beatrice exclaimed. You are too young and lovely to give up hope. You never know when Mr. Wright may walk in. Just look at me,
she said with a self-deprecating laugh.
Over the hill, overweight, in a dwindling market of men, I'd resigned myself to being a widow. I'd been alone for years. Then one sunny morning, my Bertie waltzed into the little diner on Elm Street where the girls and I breakfast every Thursday, and I fell for him harder than the fat lady at the circus takes a tumble. Dreamy as a young girl again, fussing with my hair and...
She blushed.
I even bought a few things at Victoria's Secret.
She lowered her voice and winked.
You know you've got hanky-panky on your mind when perfectly respectable white bras and panties suddenly won't do anymore, and you find yourself buying pink ones, lilac ones, lime green and the like.
Gwen cleared her throat and shifted uncomfortably, wondering if her lilac bra showed through her white tank top. But Beatrice was oblivious, chatting away.
And I'll tell you, Bertie certainly wasn't what I thought I wanted in a man. I'd always thought I liked simple, honest, hard-working men. I never thought I'd get involved with a dangerous man like my Bertie,
she confided. Her smile turned tender, dreamy.
He was with the CIA for 30 years before he retired. You should hear some of his stories. Thrilling, positively thrilling.
Gwen gaped.
Bertie was CIA?
She said, thinking,
Rainbow Bertie? You can't judge the contents of the package by the wrapper, dearie,
Beatrice said, patting her cheek.
And one more piece of advice. Don't be in too much of a rush to give it away, Gwen. Find a man who is worthy. Find a man you want to talk with into the wee hours. A man you can argue with when necessary, and a man who makes you sizzle when he touches you.
Sizzle? Gwen repeated doubtfully.
Trust me. When it's right, you'll know,
Beatrice said, beaming.
You'll feel it. You won't be able to walk away from it.
Satisfied that she'd said her piece, Beatrice planted a pink lipsticked kiss on Gwen's cheek, then rose, smoothing her sweater over her hips, before disappearing into the gaily painted inn. Gwen watched her retreat in thoughtful silence. Beatrice Hardy, age 69 and a good 50 pounds overweight, walked with confidence, glided with the grace of a woman half her size, swayed her ample bottom, and serenely displayed her cleavage. In fact, she walked like she was beautiful. Worthy. Huh. At this point, Gwen Cassidy would settle for a man who didn't require a stiff dose of Viagra. Gwen paused to rest atop the small mountain of rocks she'd climbed. After discovering she couldn't check into her room at the inn until after 4 o'clock, and firm in her resolve to not march into the nearest shop and buy a pack of that word she wasn't saying anymore, she grabbed her backpack and an apple and trotted off into the hills for an introspective hike. The hills above Loch Ness were dotted with outcroppings of stone, and the group of rocks upon which she stood extended for nearly half a mile, rising in breakneck hills and falling in jagged ravines. It had been a tough climb, but she'd relished the exercise after being cooped up in the stale air of the bus for so long. There was no denying that Scotland was lovely. She'd tromped gingerly through patches of hawthorn, skirted prickly thistles, paused to admire a rowan tree's bright red berries, and kicked about a few spiky green horse chestnuts that heralded autumn with their tumble to the ground. She'd stood long moments admiring a field of cross-leaved heath that ascended and blended with a hillside of purple-pink heather. She and a dainty red deer had spooked each other as she'd passed through the woodland clearing in which it grazed. Peace had settled over her, the higher she'd hiked into the lush meadows and rocky hills. Far beneath her, Loch Ness stretched 24 miles long, over a mile wide, and, in places, 1,000 feet deep, or so said the brochure that she'd read on the bus, highlighting the fact that the loch never froze in the winter because of its peaty, slightly acid content. The loch was a huge, silvery mirror shimmering beneath the cloudless sky. The sun, nearly at its zenith, marked the approaching noon hour and felt delicious on her skin. The weather had been unusually warm for the past few days, and she planned to take advantage of it. She flopped down on a flat rock and stretched out, soaking up the sunshine. Her group was scheduled to remain in the village until 7:30 the following morning, so she had ample time to relax and enjoy nature before reboarding the tour bus from hell. Although she'd never meet an eligible prospect up here in the foothills, at least there were no phones ringing,
with irate insureds on the other end, and no senior citizens casting nosy glances her way. She knew they gossiped about her. The old folks talked about everything. She suspected they were making up for all the times they'd held their tongues when they were young, invoking the impunity of advanced age. She found herself rather looking forward to senior immunity. What a relief it would be to say exactly what she thought for a change.
And what would you say, Gwen?
I'm lonely,
she muttered softly.
I would say that I'm lonely, and I'm damn tired of pretending that everything's fine.
How she wished something exciting would happen. It just figured that the one time she'd tried to make something happen, she'd ended up on a senior citizen's bus tour. She may as well face it. She was doomed to live a dry, uneventful, and lonely life.
Eyes shut against the bright rays, she groped for her backpack to get her sunglasses, but misjudged the distance and knocked the bag off the rock. She heard it bounce amid the clatter of loose stones for several moments, then a protracted silence, and finally a solid thump. Tucking her fringed bangs behind one ear, she sat up to see where it had fallen. She was dismayed to discover that it had tumbled off the rock, down a gully, and to the bottom of a narrow, forbidding precipice. She moved to the lip of the aperture, eyeing it warily. Her patches were in her pack, and she certainly couldn't be expected to remain a non-that word she wasn't thinking without something to take the edge off. Gauging the depth of the rocky cleft to be no more than 25 to 30 feet, she decided she was capable of retrieving it. She had no alternative. She had to go down after it. Lowering herself over the edge, she felt for toeholds. The hiking boots she'd laced on that morning had rugged, gripping soles that made the descent a little easier. However, as rough stone grazed her bare legs, she found herself wishing she'd worn jeans instead of her favorite pair of khaki Abercrombie & Fitch short shorts that were so in vogue. Her lacy white tank top was comfortable for hiking, but the faded denim button-down she'd tied around her waist just kept getting tangled about her legs, so she paused a moment to untie it and let it waft down onto her backpack. Once she reached the bottom, she'd tuck it in her pack before climbing back up. It was slow, strenuous going, but half her life was in that pack, and it was arguably the better half. Cosmetics, hairbrush, toothpaste, floss, panties, and many other items that she'd wanted on her person in case her luggage got lost.
"Oh, admit it, Gwen," she thought. "You could live out of that pack for weeks."
The sun beat down on her shoulders as she descended, and she started to sweat. It figured that the sun had to shine directly into that crack at that moment, she thought irritably. Half an hour earlier or later, and it wouldn't have penetrated there. Near the bottom, she slipped and inadvertently kicked her bag, wedging it firmly at the bottom of the narrow crevice. Squinting up into the sun, she muttered,
"Come on! I'm trying to quit smoking down here. You could help me any time now."
Easing herself down the last few feet, she placed one foot on the ground. There, she'd made it. Hardly enough room to turn around in the tight space, but she was there. Lowering her other foot, Gwen grabbed her button-down and stretched her fingers toward the strap of her pack. When the ground gave way beneath her feet, it was so sudden and unexpected that she scarcely had time to gasp before she plunged through the rocky bottom of the crevice. She fell for a terrifying few seconds, then landed with such force that the impact knocked the air from her lungs. As she struggled to draw a breath, crushed rock and dirt showered her where she lay. Adding insult to injury, the backpack fell through the hole after her and thumped her in the shoulder before rolling off into the darkness. She finally managed a ragged breath, spit hair and dirt out of her mouth, and mentally assessed her condition before attempting to move. She'd fallen hard and felt bruised from head to toe. Her hands were bleeding from her panicked attempt to catch herself as she'd plunged through the jagged opening, but blessedly, it didn't appear she'd broken any bones. Gingerly, she turned her head and gazed up at the hole through which she'd fallen. A stubborn ray of sunshine filtered down on her.
"I will not panic."
But the hole was an impossible distance above her head. Worse still, she'd not passed any other hikers during her climb. She might yell herself hoarse, yet never be found. Shaking off a nervous shiver, she peered into the gloom. The shadowy blackness of a wall loomed a few yards away, and she could hear the faint trickle of water off in the distance. Obviously, she'd fallen into an underground cavern of sorts. But the pamphlet said nothing of any caves near Loch Ness. All thought ceased abruptly as she realized that whatever she was lying upon was not rock or soil. Stunned by the abrupt fall, she'd naturally assumed she'd landed on the hard floor of a cavern. But while it was hard, it was certainly not cold. Warm, rather. And given that until a few moments ago no sunlight had penetrated this place, what were the odds that something could be warm in this cool, damp cave? Swallowing, she remained utterly still, trying to decide what she was lying on without actually looking at it. She nudged it with a hip bone. It gave slightly, and it did not feel like soil.
"I'm going to be sick," she thought. "It feels like a person."
Had she fallen into an old burial chamber? But then, wouldn't it be nothing but bones? As she debated further movement, the sun reached its zenith, and a brilliant shaft of sunlight bathed the spot where she'd fallen. Summoning all her courage, she forced herself to look down. Gwyn screamed. Chapter 2 She'd fallen on a body. One that, considering she hadn't disturbed it, must be dead. Or, she worried, perhaps I killed it when I fell. When she managed to stop screaming, she found that she'd pushed herself up and was straddling it, her palms braced on its chest. Not its chest, she realized, but his chest. The motionless figure beneath her was undeniably male. Sinfully male. She snatched her hands away and sucked in a shocked breath. However he'd managed to get here, if he was dead, his demise had been quite recent. He was in perfect condition and, her hands crept back to his chest, warm. He had the sculpted physique of a professional football player, with wide shoulders, pumped biceps and pecs, and washboard abs. His hips beneath her were lean and powerful. Strange symbols were tattooed across his bare chest. She took slow, deep breaths to ease the sudden tightness in her chest. Leaning cautiously forward, she peered at a face that was savagely beautiful. His was the type of dominant male virility women dreamed about in dark, erotic fantasies, but knew didn't really exist. Black lashes swept his golden skin, beneath arched brows and a silky fall of long black hair. His jaw was dusted with a blue-black shadow beard. His lips were pink and firm and sensually full. She brushed her finger against them, then felt mildly perverse, so she pretended she was just checking to see if he was alive and shook him, but he didn't respond. Cupping his nose with her hand, she was relieved to feel a soft puff of breath.
"He isn't dead. Thank God."
It made her feel better about finding him so attractive. Palm flushed to his chest, she was further reassured by his strong heartbeat, although it wasn't beating very often. At least it was. He must be deeply unconscious, perhaps in a coma, she decided. Whichever it was, he couldn't help her. Her gaze darted back up to the hole. Even if she managed to wake him and then stood on his shoulders, she still wouldn't be near the lip of the hole. Sunshine streamed over her face, mocking her with a freedom that was so near, yet so impossibly far, and she shivered again.
"Just what am I supposed to do now?" she muttered.
Despite the fact that he was unconscious and of no use, her gaze swept back down. He exuded such vitality that his condition baffled her. She couldn't decide if she was upset that he was unconscious or relieved. With his looks, he was surely a womanizer, just the kind of man she steered away from by instinct. Having grown up surrounded by scientists, she had no experience with men of his ilk. On the rare occasions she'd glimpsed a man like him sauntering out of Gold's gym, she'd gawked surreptitiously, grateful that she was safely in her car. So much testosterone made her nervous. It couldn't possibly be healthy. Cherry picker extraordinaire. The thought caught her off guard. Mortified, she berated herself because he was injured, and there she was, sitting on him, thinking lascivious thoughts. She pondered the possibility that she'd developed some kind of hormone imbalance, perhaps a surfeit of perky little eggs. She eyed the designs on the man's chest more closely, wondering if one of them concealed a wound. The strange symbols, unlike any tattoos she'd ever seen, were smeared with blood from the abrasions on her palms. Gwyn leaned back a few inches so a ray of sunshine spilled across his chest. As she studied him, a curious thing happened. The brightly colored designs blurred before her eyes, growing indistinct as if they were fading, leaving only streaks of her blood to mar his muscled chest. But that wasn't possible. Gwyn blinked as undeniably several symbols disappeared entirely. In a matter of moments, all of them were gone, vanished as if they'd never existed. Perplexed, she glanced up at his face and sucked in an astonished breath. His eyes were open, and he was watching her. He had remarkable eyes that glittered like shards of silver and ice, sleepy eyes that banked a touch of amusement and unmistakable masculine interest. He stretched his body beneath hers with the self-indulgent grace of a cat prolonging the pleasure of awakening, and she suspected that although he was rousing physically, his mental acuity was not fully engaged. His pupils were large and dark, as if he'd recently had his eyes dilated for an exam or taken some drug.
"Oh, God, he's conscious and I'm straddling him."
She could imagine what he was thinking and could hardly blame him for it. She was as intimately positioned as a woman astride her lover, knees on either side of his hips, her palms flat against his rock-hard stomach. She tensed and tried to scramble off him, but his hands clamped around her thighs and pinned her there. He didn't speak, merely secured and regarded her, his eyes dropping to linger appreciatively on her breasts. When he slid his hands up her bare thighs, she seriously regretted having put on her short shorts this morning. A slip of a lilac thong was all that was beneath them, and his fingers were toying with the hem of her shorts, perilously close to slipping inside. His heavy-lidded gaze reflected a languor that had nothing to do with having just awakened, and there was no doubt what was on his mind.
"But this is no safe cherry-picker,"
Gwyn thought, growing more concerned by the moment.
"This man looks like a cherry-tree chopper-downer." "Look, I was just about to get off you,"
she babbled.
"I didn't plan to sit on you. I fell through the hole and landed on you. I was hiking and accidentally knocked my backpack down a crevice, and when I went to rescue it, the ground gave way beneath me, and here I am. On that note, why didn't my falling on you wake you?"
More important, she thought, how long had he been awake? Long enough to know that she'd copped a few perverted feels? Confusion flickered in his mesmerizing eyes, but he said nothing.
"I'm usually groggy when I first wake up, too."
She tried for a reassuring tone. He shifted his hips, subtly reminding her that she didn't wake up quite like him. There was something happening beneath her, and like the rest of him, it was in-your-face male. When he smiled at her, revealing even white teeth and a slight cleft in his chin, the part of her brain that made intelligent decisions melted like chocolate taffy left by the pool on a hot summer day. Her heart raced, her palms felt clammy, and her lips were suddenly parched. For a moment she was too stupefied to feel anything but relief. So this was mindless sexual attraction. It did exist, just like in the movies. Her relief was doused by anxiety when he dragged her forward against his chest, cupped her bottom with both hands, and ground her pelvis against his. He buried his face in her hair and thrust upward, rubbing against her like a sleek and powerful animal. A hiss of breath escaped her, an involuntary reaction to a surge of desire that was far too intense to be sane. She was drowning in sensations, the possessive crush of his arms, the testosterone-laden scent of man, the sensual scrape of his shadow beard against her cheek when he caught the lobe of her ear with his teeth. And oh, that wildly erotic rhythm of his hips. He squeezed her bottom, kneading and caressing, then one hand slid upward, lingering deliciously over the hollow where her spine met her hips, inching ever upward until he palmed the back of her head and guided her lips nearer his.
"Good morrow, English,"
he said, a breath from her lips. The words were delivered in a thick brogue that sounded roughened by too much whiskey and peat smoke.
"Let me go,"
she managed, angling her face away from his. He'd fitted his erection snugly between her thighs, and a firm hand splayed across her bottom kept her locked precisely where he wanted her. He was rock-hard and hot through the lightweight fabric of her shorts. Expertly, he thrust against the most perfect spot nature had bestowed upon a woman, and Gwyn coughed to camouflage a moan. If he treated her to a few more of those cocky strokes, she might have her first real orgasm without even sacrificing her cherry.
"Kiss me,"
he murmured into her ear. His lips braised her neck. His tongue tasted her skin with lazy sensuality.
"I am not kissing you. I can understand how you might have gotten the wrong impression, waking up to find me sprawled on top of you, but I told you that I didn't mean to land on you. It was an accident." "Ah, kiss him, Gwyn,"
clamored 100 perky eggs.
"Shut up,"
she rebuked.
"We don't even know him, and until moments ago we thought he was dead. That's no way to start a relationship." "Who's asking for a relationship? Kiss, kiss, kiss,"
her babies in waiting insisted.
"Lovely lass, kiss me."
He planted a hungry, open-mouthed kiss in the sensitive area between her collarbone and the base of her throat. His teeth closed gently on her skin. His tongue lingered, sending chills up her spine.
"On my mouth."
She shuddered as the velvety stroke made her nipples pearl against his chest.
"Uh-uh,"
she said, not trusting herself to say too much.
"Nay?"
He sounded surprised, and undeterred. He nibbled the underside of her chin while splaying his hand intimately between the cleft of her behind.
"No. No way. Nay, understand? And get your hand off my butt,"
she added with a squeal when he squeezed again.
"Oh, stop that!"
Lazily, he slid his hand up from her hips to her head, availing himself of the opportunity to thoroughly caress every inch in between. Burying both hands in her hair, he gripped her near the scalp and tugged her head gently back so he could search her eyes.
"I mean it!"
He arched a dubious brow, but to her surprise, he proved to be a gentleman and slowly relinquished his grip. She scrambled off him, unaware that they'd been lying on a slab of stone that was several feet above the floor of the cavern. She stumbled to her knees on the floor. He sat up on the slab gingerly, as if every muscle in his body was stiff. He swept his gaze about the cavern, shook his head with the vigor of a drenched dog casting off rain, then gave the interior of the cave a second thorough glance. He flipped his long dark hair over his shoulder and narrowed his eyes. Gwyn witnessed the precise moment the confusion of deep slumber quit his mind. The seductive gleam in his gaze faded, and he folded his muscular arms across his chest. He glanced at her with an expression both startled and angry.
"I do not recall coming here," he said accusingly. "What have you done? Did you bring me here? Is this witchery, lass?"
"Witchery?"
"No,"
she said hastily.
"I told you I fell in through that hole."
She jerked her thumb up in the direction of the shaft of sunlight.
"And you were already in here. I landed on you. I have no idea how you got here."
His cool gaze roamed over the jagged opening, the loose stones and dirt scattered around the slab, the blood on her hands, her disheveled condition. After a moment's hesitation, he appeared to deem it a plausible story.
"If ye did not come seeking my personal attentions, why are you so shamelessly attired?"
he said flatly.
"Perhaps because it's hot out?"
she shot back, tugging defensively at the hem of her khakis. Her shorts weren't that short.
"It's not like you have much on yourself."
"'Tis natural for a man. 'Tis not natural for a woman to cut off her chemise at the waist and off her gown. Any man would make the assumption I did. You are wantonly clad, and you are draped most intimately across my loins. When a man first awakens, it sometimes takes several moments before he starts thinking clearly."
"And here I thought it took several years, perhaps a lifetime, for the average man's intellect to kick in,"
she said snidely, thinking, "Chemise?
Doff? He snorted, shaking his head again vigorously enough that it was giving her a headache.
Where am I?
He demanded.
In a cave,
she muttered, feeling less than charitable toward him. First, he'd tried to have sex with her. Then he'd insulted her clothing, and now he was behaving as if she'd done something wrong to him.
And you should apologize to me.
His brows arched with surprise.
For waking up to find a half-clad woman lying on top of me and thinking she wished me to pleasure her? I don't think so. And I am not simple,
he chided.
'Tis clear I'm in a cave. In what part of Scotland does this cave reside?
Near Loch Ness, near Inverness, she said.
She backed away from him a few steps. He blew out a relieved breath.
By Emmerdon, 'tis not too much of a fangle. I am but a few days and no many leagues from home.
Emmerdon? Fangle? Who taught the man English? His brogue was so thick that she had to listen intently to decipher what he was saying, and even then not all of it made sense. Could the glorious man have grown up in some obscure Highland village where time stood still? Cars were 20 years out of date, and the old ways and manner of speech were still revered? When he was silent for several minutes, she wondered if perhaps he really was hurt in some way and had been resting in the cave. Maybe he'd struck his head. She hadn't explored that part of him. Damn near the only part you didn't, she thought. Gwyn scowled, feeling vulnerable in the cavern with the dark, sexual man who occupied too much space and was using more than his fair share of oxygen. His confusion was only adding to her unease.
Why don't you show me the way out and we can talk outside?
She encouraged. Perhaps he'd be less attractive in broad daylight. Perhaps it was merely the dim, confined atmosphere of the cave that made him seem so large and dizzyingly masculine.
You vow you had nothing to do with how I came to be here.
She raised her hands in a gesture that said,
Why don't you just take a good hard look at little old me and then look at you?
There is that,
he agreed with her wordless rebuke.
You do not amount to much.
She refused to dignify his comment with a response. When he rose from the slab, she realized that, contrary to her initial impression, he wasn't wearing unfashionably long plaid shorts, like some of her elderly tour mates had worn, but was clad in a length of patterned fabric fastened about his waist. It brushed above his knees, and his feet and calves were encased in soft boots. She tipped her head back to look up at him, and, disconcerted by how he towered over her, blurted,
How tall are you?
She could have kicked herself when it came out sounding odd. Standing beside him, few people would amount to much. Although she'd never get involved with a man like him, it was impossible to remain unaffected by his incredible height and powerfully developed body. He shrugged.
Taller than the hearth.
The hearth?
He stopped his intent perusal of the cave and glanced at her.
How am I to think with you chattering away? The hearth in the great hall, the one Dagus and I vied to outgrow.
An expression of deep sadness crossed his face at the mention of Dagus. He fell silent a moment, then shook his head.
He never did. Missed by so much.
He demonstrated the space of an inch with his finger and thumb.
I'm taller than my father, and taller than two of the stones at Bandrecade.
I meant in feet,
she clarified. Speaking of the mundane gave her a measure of calm. He eyed his boots a moment and appeared to be doing some rapid calculations.
Forget it. I get the picture.
6.5 feet, perhaps taller. And to a woman 5'3" on her best day, daunting. She stooped and grabbed her backpack, sliding a strap over her shoulder.
Let's go.
Hold. I am yet unprepared for travel, lass.
He moved to a pile by the wall, which Gwyn had thought was a jumble of rocks. She watched nervously as he retrieved his belongings. He did something she didn't quite follow with the blanket thingy he was wearing, where part of it ended up over one shoulder. After fastening a pouch about his waist, he draped wide bands of leather over each shoulder so that they crossed in an X over his chest.
These he secured at his waist with another wide band of leather that belted them snugly in place. Then he donned a fourth band that encircled his pecs. Was he dressing in some old costume? Gwen wondered. She'd seen something similar to his attire in a castle her group had toured yesterday, on one of the medieval sketches in the armory. Their guide had explained that the bands fashioned a sort of armor, adorned in critical places, such as above the heart and over the abdomen, with ornate metal discs. As she watched, he fastened similar leather bands that stretched from wrist to elbow around his powerful forearms. She stared in silence when he began tucking dozens of knives away, knives that looked alarmingly real. Two went into each wristband, handle toward his palm, 10 on each crossband. When he bent to the dwindling pile and hefted a massive double-bladed axe, she flinched. Cherry tree chopper downer, indeed. Definitely not a man a woman could take any chances with. He raised an arm and lowered it behind his right shoulder, sliding the handle into the bands across his back. Last, he sheathed a sword at his waist. By the time he was done, she was aghast.
Are those real?
He turned a cool, silver gaze on her.
Aye, you can scarce kill a man otherwise.
Kill a man?
She repeated faintly. He shrugged and eyed the hole above them and said nothing for a long while. Just when she was beginning to think he'd forgotten her entirely, he said,
I could toss you that eye.
Oh, yes, he probably could. With one arm, she thought.
No, thank you,
she said frostily. Small she might be, a basketball she was not. He grinned at her tone.
But I fear doing so might cause more rocks to collapse upon us. Come, we will find a way out.
She swallowed.
You really don't remember where you came in?
Nay, lass, I'm afraid I don't.
He measured her for a moment.
Nor do I recall why,
he added reluctantly. His response troubled her. How could he not know how or why he'd entered the cave, when he had obviously come in, removed his weapons, and piled them neatly before lying down? Did he have amnesia?
Come, we must make haste. I care not for this place. You must put your clothes back on.
Her hackles rose, and she barely resisted the urge to hiss like a cat.
My clothes are on.
He raised a brow, then shrugged.
As you will. If you are comfortable strolling about in such a fashion, far be it from me to complain.
Crossing the chamber, he took her wrist and began dragging her along. Gwen allowed him to tug her behind him for a short distance, but once they'd left the cavern, all light disappeared. He was guiding them by feeling his way along the wall of the tunnel. His other hand latched about her wrist, and she began to fear they might plunge into another crevice, hidden by the darkness.
Do you know these caves?
She asked. The blackness was so absolute that it was crowding her in, suffocating her. She needed light, and she needed it now.
Nay, and if you are telling me the truth and you fell through the hole, then you do not either,
he reminded.
Have you a better idea?
Yes,
she tugged on his hand.
If you'll just stop a moment, I can help.
Have you fire to light our way, we English? For 'tis what we sorely need.
His voice was amused, and it irritated her. He'd taken her measure, deemed her helpless, and that pissed her off. And why did he keep calling her English? Was it the Scottish version of American, and perhaps they called people from England British? She knew she had a trace of an English accent because her mother had been raised and schooled in England, but it wasn't that pronounced.
Yes, I do,
she snapped. He stopped so suddenly that she ran into the back of him, striking her cheekbone on the handle of his axe. Although she couldn't see him, she felt him turn, smelled the spicy male scent of his skin. Then his hands were on her shoulders.
Where have you fire? Here?
He sifted his fingers through her long hair.
Nay, perhaps here.
His hand brushed her lips in the dark, and if she hadn't clamped them shut, he would have slipped the tip of his finger between them. The man was positively outrageous, hell-bent on seduction with a single-mindedness that made her fear for her resolve.
Ah,
here, he purred, sliding his hand over her derriere, then yanking her against him. He was still erect. Unbelievable, she thought, dazedly. He laughed, a husky, confident sound.
I do not doubt you have fire, but 'tis naught that might help us escape this cave, though it would undoubtedly make it vastly more amenable.
Oh, definitely mocking now. She twisted away from his liberty-taking hands.
You are so arrogant! Have all those steroids eaten away your brain cells?
He was silent a moment, and his lack of response unnerved her. She couldn't see him and wondered what he was thinking. Was he preparing to pounce on her again? Finally, he said slowly,
I do not understand your question, lass.
Forget it. Just let go of me so I can get something out of my pack, she said stiffly.
She slipped it off her shoulder and thrust it at him.
Hold this a minute.
While she'd been willing to discard her cigarettes, throwing away a perfectly good lighter had seemed wasteful. Besides, she'd quit before, and then when she started again, she had to buy a new lighter every time. Rummaging in one of the external pockets, she sighed with relief when her fingers closed on the silver Bic. When she pressed the little button, he roared and leaped back, his heavy-lidded eyes glittering.